Okay, it's Graham Atwell in the Institutional Innovation Show, accompanying the JISC SSBR Conference on Institutional Innovation. We're going to go to a live feed from the conference now, where George Roberts is just introducing Professor John Cook's keynote speech.
Very pleased to welcome John Cook with Scaffolding the Mobile Way.
Thank you very much, George. After such a huge build-up, I'm hoping I'm not going to be too disappointing. Can you all just do a smiley, make sure you can hear me? Do a couple of smileys, great. I've got some Illuminate headphones on, actually. I got them free at a conference, but of course that meant I had to they had to phone me up a lot and wanting to see me. So anyway, but that's another story, isn't it? You know, the things we have to go through. Right, I can see my slides are sort of coming up. They're slightly garbled there. I love the music. It's great to come in, and as George says, I've got a big music background. I love music's my religion, to be honest. And I'm on Blip FM sometimes, where I regard myself as an investigative DJ, which I think I'm the first of a genre there. But other people have been using that a lot more than me. So Scaffolding the Mobile Wave is the title of the talk. I'm John Cook from the Learning Technology Research Institute. Yes, me and George did meet at Soodley, and I'd been working with people who worked on ontologies for many years before that, and hence in AI and education. And so I know that's not only a joke, but a serious matter. And I still work with people who are working on ontologies. There's no getting away from it, George. You guys will take over the world soon. So essentially, my job is twofold. I have taught for many years in youth clubs, doing logo, then in further education, then in higher education for 16 years as a lecturer in multimedia. Then I've been a researcher, full-time researcher, for about 8 years now. Part of my job is I'm the e-learning project leader for the university. I'm meant to be helping out with the e-learning for a university, but our university, London Met, has severe problems, which those of you who don't know, we've got a big budget deficit and lots of redundancies on the horizon. So it's a difficult environment within which I'm working. So I've got lots of experience, plenty of 16 years experience of full-time of research as well. So, right, let me just, if I do something wrong or I'm not really got the kind of this genre right, let me know, in particular moderators or anybody. It's the first time I've done an Illuminate sort of presentation. So moving on, hopefully, let's see, where's that button there? That should do it. No, that one doesn't do it. Let's try this one. Okay, so the buttons at the top. Will these move? Oh, it's moving. It's just very slow. Got it. And I hope it's not going to jump to the end now. So there's the structure of the talk. I've built in lots of time for discussion and things coming through the chat room. So I want this to be as interactive as possible. I must apologize if I talk too fast. I get excited about my things. Tell me to slow down. I also apologize because I've got to move off to give another talk at Mobile Learning Telling Tales. So I've just been granted moderator privileges. I look forward to catching up with your discussions later on. The million quid, Josie, that was, I'm the person who turned down the Beatles in a way. The KLF, Jimmy Courtney made £1 million before I knew him. He did the Athena drawing of Gandalf on a hill. Then we played in bands, we best Peel bands of John Peel sessions of 82, I think it was. And then we played all over an indie band, Angels on Fire. Then I left that band and he went on to make millions with KLF and Doctor Who and all that. Anyway, so that's another story. I still see him from time to time. There's the structure. Let me see if I get there. If I don't, I'm happy to just go into questions. I do like questions actually in my own talk. So if the moderators can keep an eye out for good questions, and we've got gaps in there for looking at it, and what people are thinking about what I'm saying. So I'm going to be slightly contentious, I think, but then that's nothing new there, as George will understand. But then it's based on some of my earlier work, and there's some references at the end of the slides, where I've been looking at how we can regard what we call new digital media as cultural resources for learning. Although I've got a background in computing science, and now I'm firmly in education. I've been working with a lot of people from cultural and media studies, so my perspective is quite broad and interdisciplinary. And so what I want to look at is how we can enable the bringing together of the informal context in the world outside, where we know, as we know, a lot of things are going on outside the kind of formal learning institutions, with the processes and contexts that are valued inside institutions. So I'm a dreamer and a realist, all rolled into one, if, as you'll see. Right, that's the wrong button. There we go. And to summarise, this is my talk in a nutshell, in case you have to go off and go dance somewhere or go to a disco or have a cup of coffee. The big some reports are showing that social software, there's one from Bechter and Google Search, are not enabling the critical, creative and reflective thinking that we value in formal education. I don't know what people think about that. As I say, I'm going to be contentious. But I'm arguing that we need to scaffold learning in a new context for learning, which I'm going to, for now, describing as the mobile wave, which I'll explain in a minute. And here are some challenging questions to getting people going, with an eye on the near future trends that I've been writing a few books lately, working with people in particular from the Institute of Education, Norbert Patchler, Gunther Kress, and some guys from Germany. So I've been looking at this in quite some detail. I've got a book coming out in the autumn on mobile learning with Springer. How can these learning activities that are going on outside and have been going on, you know, let's say informal learning has been going on for centuries, but using the new digital media, how can we take the activities that are going on outside, place the formal institution, and put but use the platforms that are selected by learners? Now, here's a key, and I'll show you why in a second, to why I think there's a problem. But how can we bring that all into the institutional learning? Now, this is the GIST challenge. I want you to sort of look at this. Given that we're in 2010 is only 6 months away, are we nearing the GIST vision? So just I'll read this out. It's, I'm sure you can all read as well. But part of the GIST e-learning program vision in a recent call, Circular 408, was for but the UK learning environment by 2010, within this environment, learners and teachers are using a mixture of institutionally provided and user-owned technologies in a confident and effective manner. So what's the answer to this? I think that's not happening. I don't know, your view may be different, but I think really in my institution and many HE and indeed FE, that's not happening in schools even, especially in schools, that's not happening as well. So there's a bit of a kind of schism there going on, I think, between what's going on in the world at large and in more formal institutions. And indeed, in a recent report, has helpfully summarised the current state of affairs. This report does seem to, it's by MIT, some authors, and what they've done is use work that a lot of us have been doing over the years, and not kind of mentioned it, which is a shame, but they've done it for particular reasons to get it to policymakers, I think. But what the report argues, which I agree, is that there's a traditional institutions must adapt or risk to grow the growing mismatch between how they teach and the next generation of learners. And they also suggest that the forms and models of learning have evolved quickly in fundamentally new directions. Okay, so that's the kind of the thrust of the report. And in particular, how we teach, where we teach, who teaches, and who administers and serves, they've only changed around the edges. So that's the kind of thrust of a good summary of what a lot of people have been saying in the UK and abroad for some time now. And the authors also go on to say that young people today are learning in new ways that are both collective and egalitarian. Universities must recognize this new way of learning and adapt or risk becoming obsolete. And today's learning is interactive and without walls. And I was reading the Times Eye today. I work in a university in particular, so there's talk of some universities going to the wall unless they learn to be more adaptive. So this is very high in everybody's minds. Especially in these times of recession when the funding purses are tight. I think there's a problem, though, with just taking that view that everything that goes on in the world at large is perfect, as I've alluded to. It is learning and socialising. There are certain types of things, but the criticality, the reflective thinking, creative thinking that we value in particular, I'm talking about higher education, but FE and schools, maybe that's not going on according to some reports. And so we need to find a way of bridging the two. And the outside in, inside out is my way of summarising that particular way of doing things, the problem, as it were. And indeed, if we're talking about user-owned technology, it's in the GIST challenge I mentioned in the introduction. For about 4 billion users around the world already are appropriating mobile devices, and that's in countries like Africa. There's a larger penetration of mobile devices than PC-based, we've got landlines. There's a real penetration across the world. That's well over half the world's population have got mobile phones, and often people from poorer backgrounds, they've got trainers first, they've got mobile phones, and then eventually they'll eat. In Africa, people will miss a meal to send a text. So the mobile phones penetrated the world as a personal device in a massive way in their everyday lives, sometimes with increasing sophistication in the way their practices they use. And it's often through their, what I call their agency, their motivation, their personal interests and the collective interests. So that's what's happening in the world at large, which is quite phenomenal. From an institutional perspective, I call this, as I say, the outside-in, inside-out problem. What I'm kind of asking here is how can learning activities that take place outside the formal institutions on the platform of the learner's choice be brought into institutional learning? And I know, for example, in schools, they're often left at the door, the mobile phones, they're banned, or they're suffered in silence. So the idea is to try and how can we use them in a more constructive way, and in higher education, they could be used to get through to people. And so there's an issue there, both for lots of issues there. I'm not going to unpack them just here because I think there's lots of room for debate there. But I would claim that these new media are having a transformative effect on learning, and that people are using them in their revision, getting bite size on their mobile phones, in schools. People are using them to organise themselves in learning in higher education in FE. And Lillian Soon in FE does some great work on what mobiles can be used to do, and we've done some workshops with her. So there's a lot going on, but it's still at the fringes, I'm afraid, in my view. But you can disagree with me. I'm being provocative. Banging on about this outside in, inside out, the cultural practices, we call them, they're things that people do outside in the world, both on a cultural basis. If you think about it, SMS texting became well known not because of why it was invented. It became well known because people were using it in a different way. It was invented for text telemetry and text alerts for and that was it. But it's used for social smart mobs, as Harold Reigant says. So it became used in a, people used appropriated the media in a way that wasn't expected by designers, and that's what I love about the new media and technologies. Cultural practices, and that's one cultural practice I've just described, involving these new digital media can be brought into the institution. That's my thrust, and these practices can be enhanced inside the institution by the criticality, the creativity, analytical thinking, and then in turn fed back into the digital world. So that's, just to reiterate what I'm arguing for here. And thus new digital media can be regarded as a cultural resource. That's what I mean. These things are out there. We use them as a resource, a cultural resource inside formal learning. But those definitions are breaking down when we look at work-based learning, and which is something Graham Atwell and myself are working on in the with Mature project, which is a framework 7. Don't Google Mature. You'll get some very strange results if you do just that. But Google Mature FP7 IP. It's an integrating project, and we're looking at work-based learning. We've got some very interesting partners there, Credit Suisse, SAP, the second largest software corporation in the world, plus lots of universities, as always, in these projects. So work-based learning is really, we're really looking at this also, the scaffolding the mobile wave. And the new digital media can be regarded as a cultural resource to enable the bringing together of the informal learning context in the world outside. This is something I've been very interested in for many years, but with the processes and context that are valued inside institutions. So I'm asking for a perfect match here, a marriage, I suppose, of the two. So just scrolling down there. So the new media like YouTube, as you know, can already be accessed by mobile devices and on PC-based, and are changing the way people view media practices. Like we used to have in the UK, the BBC push editorial approach, where you had to wait for a scheduled programme to arrive on your television and then before you could watch it. Well, they've changed that slightly, the BBC, in response to the kind of changes in media practices with iPlayer. But what's happening with YouTube, you can watch things often when you want. And as I say, the BBC's response has been for iPlayer, which you can programme and watch programmes in a different way. But you've got this kind of user-generated content, and this is creating a whole new way in which media is being viewed, and different platforms are arriving, like YouTube, MySpace, Facebook, and so on. And informal learners are able to actively select and appropriate and implement learning solutions to meet their own needs. You know, so we all, I think you all know what I'm talking about, but if you do, if you search for learning on YouTube, you get some fascinating results. The big problem is that, as I mentioned, the reports show that social software, that's the report by Bechter, and perhaps Google search are not enabling these kinds of thinking that are valued in formal education. The Google search report by the British Library and JISC, the Google generation, they're suggesting in their results that people, what's happening is people are putting in a search term into Google and hitting return and then taking the first answer that comes along. And that's not just the learners, it's professors, which amuses me, that people aren't doing the kind of deep searching and criticality looking at research resources on the internet, which we still need. So that's the challenge, I think, for us. And if you're ever involved in any conversations with large groups of staff, as I am, about moving over to use of new digital technologies, you will hit these discourses massively. And I think I'd be interested to hear what other people's experiences on this. That was kind of a quick burst of activity from me. I probably talked too fast, but I think you get where I'm coming from. And I want the moderators to quickly, if you could summarize any key sort of discussion points that are coming along. We've got until, it looks like, 10:45, so quite a way to go. So if there's a framing question, George is interested in the myth of criticality. Critical thinking, postmodernism. I did my PhD, George, in how to critical thinking for music, and we use poetry, Matthew Lipman, the poems to think critically about the world. I think. Do you want to stick your hand up, George, and come in on the mic and say what you mean? Now, who hands over to you? Let's see. If I turn off, you talk, George.
Hello, John. You don't have to turn off. We can have up to four microphones open, so it's probably best if you leave yours open, and if people want to come in, they just click.
I've left it on. Can you still hear me?
Oh yeah.
Can you still hear me? Yeah. No. You go ahead, George. Actually, talk about this criticality thing.
Well, this really is just a contentious observation of the counter proposition that there is. And a presumption made by lecturers and people that work in higher education that users of technology are not engaging with critical thinking, are not using it critically, where it embraces a broad range of practices from information seeking and retrieval, you know, do you trust Wikipedia and or Google, to the kinds of social networking practices that people might engage in that would appear to be of a risky nature. Now, so I guess I just find that sometimes it sounds to me like too many teachers simply say that kids these days aren't using tools critically and we have to teach them to be more critical with their use of information technology tools. And it strikes me that this may be one of those same as it ever was things, that that people grow critically through their lives. Generations tend to mistrust others. And I guess I just wonder whether it's a generational thing, whether it's one of these sort of institutional cultural barriers where teachers, lecturers, academics make the assumption that because the practices are very different, that they are consequently uncritical. I put that position sort of contentiously because I actually have some sympathy for it, but I think it's one of the ones that we have to ask ourselves. We have to be critical about it ourselves. Are people really using the tools in as uncritical a fashion as we think they are? Or is it that they just have different aims?
Thanks, George. Basically, I think they are using them in a very creative and critical and analytical way in many respects in their own cultural practices. And that's if when I start to unpack the argument that we're making in the new book that's coming out on mobile learning for Springer. We're saying we take the big case study of a chap in Germany, a young man who is a second-generation immigrant and sees himself as the underdog and the outsider. But he's become a big expert in using the digital media, and he's got various websites, and he's an expert in putting these things up in a very sophisticated way. And he presents different personas to the world. One of them is quite rebellious. He goes and takes videos of drunken German men unconscious and puts them on the internet and he's even put a swastika on it, and he's now finding himself he's being prosecuted by one of the states because it's against the law to do that when someone's unprotected, and particularly the swastika aspect. But another aspect of his persona is that he puts very trendy, has a great haircut, and he puts himself up on the website as being very with it. And he appeared in GQ magazine because of this. And on another part of his persona, they go on. He was in the army. He likes being in the army because it made him more middle class. And so it's very, very, there's a lot going on out there. I use these as headlines to draw people in, colleagues, like saying this, but then they say, oh, nothing's going on out there, like you say. And they say, well, they are going out there, but they're not the things sometimes people recognize as criticality, analytical creativity. But once you start, what I'm saying is, yes, they are going on out there, draw them in. And use them within the formal education, because there's a lot. We'll get onto this later. There's a lot of cultural barriers to using new technology and learning from my colleagues in higher education, although it's changing, thank goodness. But going back to this case study, my colleague from Germany, he had real trouble contacting him because he wanted to talk to him, and the only way he could get through to him was he left an email message with his barber. And so this guy got back to him through the barber's email saying, yeah, I'll meet you, because he was about to be prosecuted by the German state authorities. So that's quite interesting. There's been a few other questions, which I'm trying to track them. And Patrick O'Reilly says Google Scholar is a great start, though, and can often appear find papers not available with it. Yes, I agree, Scholar. Google's great, and I'll be getting onto Google. They provide some amazing resources. And Laura said it's not because they are mobile phones, but isn't it because they are mobile phones? Isn't it because they are mobile phones in some way? Not trying to be tech deterministic, but isn't there something about the kind of tech? I think there is. I think there's something odd about, I would agree with that totally. There's something about personalizing a personal device. You can take these devices everywhere with you. They become part of your identity. You can change the ringtones. You can change the background. You put your music on it. You can do all sorts. And people use them in railway carriages, we know, to break up with boy or girlfriends. People use them on the toilet, in the bedroom, in the bath, on the beach. There's something odd about mobile phones, which is why and the fact there's so many in the world. This is what, and young people have got them as well. At the age of 8, there's kind of a huge Ofcom report showing a lot of people have got them. And there's another comment that LLIDA was an initial audit of the skills and has produced suggestions of the way forward. So there's lots of good comments coming through, which looking at the time now, I need to press on. So let me just move on to the next section. Thanks for all your comments. Keep them coming. And George in particular, thanks for your comments. That's livened me up. I've gone off on a tangent, as I love to do. Scaffolding the mobile wave. So what I've done here is take a look at some near future technology that I think is quite impressive and try to imagine how we should be using it in a way that's ubiquitous, that everybody's using it. So my personal view, based on working in projects and European projects and reading of the literature and dealing with the public a lot, is that we need to use technology to scaffold the learning. So scaffolding, this is a technical term. It came from Bruner and Wood, David Wood, is that it's where, for example, a more able partner helps a learner understand the problem and hence make sense of the world. And these roles can change, and it could take place in groups. So this is what happens in the open source community. I'm not saying it doesn't happen. Don't get me wrong, George and colleagues. It does happen, but this is a technical term which we can use in order to scaffold the learning that goes in higher education. And mobile devices will be a major platform, I think. Make use of something called Google Wave. There's some links there. Go off and see the Google Wave developer preview. There's a link there. But don't go yet. it's about 90 minutes long. It is fascinating. This Google Wave system has been developed. It works on multiple platforms, mobile device included, and it's like It's been developed by the people who brought us Google Maps. So it's 2 years in the making. They've released it at prototypes, still at beta stage. So it's interesting that they've done that. I think things like this will take over the world, be widely available, make and what it does is it's basically a hosted conversation that lives in one place. So if you think Twitter and Facebook and everything all combined, it allows you to do that in one place. In real time, you can see what people are typing, adding, bringing photos, bringing new people to your conversation. The conversation saved as an object, and they claim, the Google people, that if you were inventing email now, this is where you would start from. But there's some health warnings here that although you're allowed to set up your own Google Wave server, there's some licensing problems, privacy issues we need to watch out for. As Martin Wolf, as a colleague on the New Role project, suggested that we don't know sometimes what licensing deal you'll sign and all the content. Does it send it off to Google what you're doing with all these conversations, and you know, what are they going to get out of it? So I'm not being totally technologically deterministic here. We have to watch for this. But based on some Horizon reports, if you haven't seen them, there's a link, there's a reference there, and the link's in the references at the back end of this presentation, that they're predicting that mobile broadband and smartphones and cloud computing will be here, in particular in formal education, over the next 2 years. So what I'm saying is not so unreasonable based on their predictions, and what I'm saying is that in 2 years, these communication waves, that things like Google Wave enable, will become a mobile wave environment, which allow learners to mix and match the services that suit their own needs. So in the Mature projects, Graham and I, we're building personalized learning and maturing environments and organizational learning and maturing environments. So I'm quite influenced by what things I've discussed with Graham in terms of this matching of services. But I can see it to be very much in the way, what will happen is the way the iPhone apps are currently being used now, that people can bring in apps that suit their personal needs, and the kind of intuitivity of the interface is quite important. It will involve things like the G2, the Android phone from Google, and whatever others. I think Nokia, Symbian are losing out in this respect at the moment. They may be bringing out an Android phone. Forgive my digression into platforms then. So consequently, in the talk, I'll now give two examples that were developed at LTRI in terms of through to give an example of what I mean by the mobile wave, how we can scaffolding it, and I hope this is colleagues are going to find this interesting. The two examples are, one's mobile urban education, one's mobile Cistercian abbeys, and these involve deep thinking, scaffolding of deep thinking with mobile phones. Of course, these are out and about, but mobile phones can be used inside if RFID tags, near field communication, Wi-Fi is enabled, and that's going to develop within the institution as well. But see, there's a reference there to go see one of my things in SlideShare, talks on urban phases of mobile learning. Excuse me, I'm stumbling a bit there. Okay, so scaffolding, just to complete what I'm talking about here, is the goal should be to enable the learners to appropriate the mobile wave. So appropriation is what the users do. It's there. They take things and use them in a way that designers don't expect. I'm really interested in this and how people do things, how communities get hold of technologies and media and use them in unexpected ways that suit their practice needs. And that's what I'm talking about here. Learners will configure the mobile wave so that it blends their personal apps, their applications, with the apps that the institution provides and that the learner provides useful. So, for example, to put into concrete terms what I'm talking about, it could involve a timetable, an alert to a room change. That really bamboozles a lot of students. A location fix on fellow students in a study set. There's lots of research that face-to-face study sets or e-learning enhanced ones and make you a more successful learner in formal education. And we know that we band together in groups and work collaboratively in informal ways, and open sources that model as well to a certain extent. Resources that scaffold learning when the tutor's not around, that's important, what I'm talking about. So for deep learning, apps that enable employment with the tutor or somebody to help you, or with a group of doing an assignment, and deep learning apps, say, for urban education and so on. So that's what I mean by this. So here are some examples. No, look, I should have deleted that. Second level. Just to say, this is EC-funded work. It's called ConSens. It's a context sensitivity project. It's a lifelong learning project headed by Ericsson, but it involves Junchi Labs and lots of a couple of other partners from Hungary and Bulgaria. And the LTRI team, I must give them a name check, as well as myself, is Carl Smith, the developer, Claire Bradley and the urban planning, Simon Pratt Adams did the work on with that. He's in the Department of Education. So here we go. So going for a local walk about urban planning. This is set in. I work on the Holloway Road, and this is just. I can see it from here where we did this walk about. It's there's an urban area near where I work. We've explored since the 1850s to present day, looking at exploring how schools are signifiers of both urban change and continuity of educational policy and practice. So the aim of this project was to, try to contextualize social and historical accounts of urban education, we're looking at the surrounding discourses. And another aim of the project was to scaffold the trainee teachers' understanding of what is possible with mobile learning for field trips. So that gives you a flavor of what we're doing. Here's the map. We go up Eden Grove, go around and back down St. George's Road, and we used Mediascape open source software to set up lots of little zones, and then we had various scripts enabled that were activated when people enter these zones, students or colleagues, and activities, and that's the basic sort of scenario. Let me see. Here's some pictures we used in the mid. So there's people when they enter the different zones, they enter into rich multimedia sort of experiences, as well as task-oriented things based on around this techno space sort of walkthroughs. You really experience the whole thing with the mobile phones. People were working in pairs. With one mobile phone with a GPS, so it's the GPS-enabled zones of activities, 10 of them, and the other person in the pair had another phone, which they'd record their thoughts, take pictures, and so on and so forth for reflection to upload later for their presentation. You can see here what happened is these, I don't know if I can, is there a pointer or a tool here? Let me click on this and see if it works. I don't know if you can see the pointer. George, can you see the pointer or not? No. No. In the middle, you can see the school started off post-revolution, post-industrial revolution as no pointer. Okay. In the middle, you can see them. They're a bit like factories. They started off schools. These are all pictures of schools on the right-hand side. They started off like factories or indeed like prisons of controlled entrance. And that's what happened is like the industrialized model of schools. Later in the 60s, there's a pointer. Yeah, very good. I don't know who's that's the one. Thank you. Yep. Whoever's got that. But then the one on the top, the third from the right on the top, and when we got to the 50s and 60s, they became flatter and very good. Oh, there's a little pointer. They came in flatter. The classroom was closer to the playground, and so, you know, it was more humane, would you believe? And so that's what the kind of discourse we're talking about within this mobile tour. These are all from Pathé News, these content, so it's all free. And when people stand in the street next to a particular building, they get pictures from the 1930s of processions down that street. This was one of the poorest, and still is a very poorest areas in Europe. It's called Ringcross Estate. It's historically... from medieval times, it's King's Cross is just up the road. Down the A1, you come to Ringcross. So it's like going lots of history. There's about 7 schools down there. I used to work on that road, and I never noticed half of these. It was fascinating to have the tour and rediscover what was going on there. So students go around in pairs. There are trainee teachers, typically MA or BSc students, working in the pairs there. You can see them. We have a very mixed intake of students. We've got a high level of international students. So you can see there they're working together with the two different types of phones, HTC Touch and Nokia N95s, doing the business there. And what's interesting is that we evaluated this and we got really positive results. 91% thought the mobile tour enhanced the learning experience. The information was easy to assimilate. Concrete tasks, reflection in situ, active learning, not merely taking in information. These are very positive results we got. But as always with, I know Jessica interested in the learner voice, as I've always been interested in the user-centered design since the early 90s. Here's a great quote, and I would have paid for this. The information given was underlined by the experience of the area and therefore given context in both past and present. And it was triggering my own thoughts, and I was getting to think for myself about the area and the building. So real, very positive results there. Second example, because I don't want to, I want to leave time for questions. Yeah, I'm still okay, just about. Is to do with Carl Smith and Claire Bradley. It's work in progress. This is construction of the abbeys, Cistercian abbeys in the kind of 1132 around that area, was for the Cistercian order. And in Yorkshire, there's, I don't know if you know this, about six or seven beautiful ruined abbeys. I'm from Yorkshire, so I will plug Yorkshire. This Fountains Abbey is the one we were particularly working on. Carl Smith, he used to work at Sheffield University doing the Cistercian Abbeys project. So we've got all these beautiful 3D models, which we used, reduced the size and repurposed for this project, so that archaeologists from Sheffield went out to the abbeys and used the mobile tour that we've developed through the Consens project to really experience that site in a different way. What's interesting, so some higher education, we're getting people to do some deep learning, hopefully. Well, we did, the results show that. But what's interesting is there are two communities in the Cistercian order where monks from the choir in the eastern part of the church and the lay brothers were in the west, and so they were divided. Carl worked with many archaeologists and specialists on the project to rebuild how they looked in the past, the abbeys, using basic building blocks, the kind of different stones that were used. So it's quite a sophisticated project. But there are MA landscape archaeology students that were on the trip. This is the kind of thing, Carl looked at some of the original buildings. On the top right, you can see he's done a projection of how it used to look, a wireframe, as we call it. Bottom left, we're looking at an improved version of how that arch above it would look looks. And so we then, from on the bottom right, we get wireframes which show how in their glory the Cistercian abbeys would have looked in the past. And we can then rotate them, because in 3D Max it's quite exciting stuff. Even now, the project still was around for a while. Here are some students out there in the Abbey going through it, working in pairs again. So what they've got is these three, they've got a task to look at how these abbeys were constructed from the basic stones, the building blocks, how the arches and the naves were built. And what's going on is quite fascinating in terms of the mobile wave. They're working in pairs, they can upload the information, but there's some collaborative learning going on with the visualizations provided by this virtual abbeys. So they look, there's a gap between the physical world, what they're seeing in front of them, what's left of the Cistercian abbeys, Fountains Abbey in this case, the virtual world on the mobile phone, and there's a shared cognition between the students. They're coming to understandings of how these things were constructed in a very deep way. And this transcript that I added from those students you see in the picture show what I mean. So, and I won't go through the transcript, but you can look at it, but they're talking about vaults, what's there, what isn't. So there's this say of, so those have changed since then, and there's this idea that you can see, you cannot see that one, and you can see that, and you can see it's this way, and both stare in the space where there's a missing pillar should have been. So there's a real sense that they've been taken forward through this, through the combination of technology and the real world, the physical world, in a way that quite literally could not be done by any other technology. And this is part of the mobile wave that I've seen as being part of the future. We're doing things here that can't be done by books. It's brilliant, actually. I'm quite excited about it, as you can gather. Here's some results just to show you how they thought about this. And not all good, as I'll show you in a minute, but the users are extremely positive, and it's more fun than they expected. And two said it was very interesting, very good. 80% rated as being useful, 60% thought the mobile device enhanced the learning experience. There were some problems with GPS. Three found that having to look at the mobile device was a distraction. And I found with studies that if people have never used this technology before for learning, they don't quite get it. It's only after they've done it, or as it becomes more commonplace, that they understand the potential. And the same could be said for staff, colleagues. They don't get the potential of mobile phones. One colleague said, well, if you're using it on the bus, don't you get jiggled about a lot? And it's kind of, there's a gap to be bridged there. 80% agreed that the mobile learning experience was fun. 9 out of 10, 90% were going to take another mobile learning course. So, you know, you get the flavor of where I'm heading with this. So two examples, and here's a good last quote. The ability to be in a particular position but get a variety of views, different visual perspective, was a very useful opportunity. The whole thing also got everyone talking in a way I hadn't experienced on the field trip at Fountains before. So people who've been there before found the whole thing a positive experience. And I haven't done that tour yet. So I look forward to when I get next trip to Yorkshire, I'll take a detour to Fountains. That's the fun side of life. We got any more discussion coming through? I can just see a moderator comment. Josie, I warned him about you. Graham, what are you on about? How do we go beyond good and useful examples like the one I presented above? That's a question that George would have liked me to ask. And how do we move towards wide-scale practitioner and institutional uptake? Hand raised. Okay, go ahead. I can't work out who's got the hand raised. But yeah, who's coming in?
John, it's Graham here. Yeah, they were talking in the chat room that you're doing very well at avoiding distractions, and I said that I'd warned them. But the question, one question that did come up in the chat, which I thought was a useful question, is that, well, what's the cost in providing students with mobile devices, and how do you make sure you get them all back in working order?
Well, for now, we use the smartphones, which when we started out, go backwards 6 years. We started developing learning objects using Flash, and it wasn't widespread then, and we kind of took a chance and it became widespread. And we think the functionality of the smartphones are increasingly given away with contracts, 95s, you know, the different, HTC Magic is a Google Android phone that can do it now. So they cost us, quite frankly, £500. But that was a year or two ago because we wanted to experiment with what's happening. But we're looking now to, as you know, Graham, we're looking at in projects using Google Android or something like that. And these are the phones that everyone will have. There is an interoperability problem in that you've got iPhone, which is its own operating system. You've got Google's operating system, Android. You've got Symbian, which is Nokia. And you've got Windows Mobile, which we're using here. There is an interoperability problem. I won't pretend that. And there's a cost. We got all the phones back. Yeah. If you ever meet me, any guys, whoever, you know, you'll notice I can do a very mean glare. We didn't get any nicks, which is a relief. What we did was we took a deliberate policy of letting, in many other projects, let them put their own music on it and customize it so that they had a sense of ownership. So that's it. Kind of a good tip. Any other questions? There's Carl Marshall saying, and interoperability is a strong principle we are building on. Yeah. Does anyone else want to come in? Please go ahead, whoever's got your hand raised. George.
That was me, John. And it's really just a question about the difficulty that you have with markets and the tie-in between the hardware, the software, and the networks, where at least one dimension of the relationship is an attempt to capture commercial revenue streams. Somebody's got a...
Yeah. I agree. I think
is that a warning? An anti-capitalist speaker warning coming up in the background. I am just interested. I mean, the whole thing with
Sorry, yeah, the noise is. I'm on the Holloway Road. This is a war zone. Thanks, Josie. George, let me come in on that. We've always had to piggyback in education on the back of commercialism, which is why when I gave the presentation of Google Wave, I was very clear to say we've got to watch out. You've got to be careful. It's not going to become the next Microsoft. So I'm just trying to look a bit in the future of how we can scale up, though. I think it's not a done deal, and that's why, as I would say, we need more. Research, but I don't think it is a done deal. And hello, Rhonda. A mean scare could be a librarian, that's for sure. Yeah. Anyone got any good points? Because I have got conclusions, and then there's time for questions at the end, so I can just press on with my final conclusions. What's wrong with Microsoft? Laurie. Well, I use Microsoft products, and I used to use Macs because I was a musician. I want to appropriate them, whatever they are, for use, and I want to see how other people are appropriating whatever it is. I can't I'm trying to predict, but I can't, how things will take off. But I think you have to have the mindset. It's that I'll do the ATM story of how banks invented ATMs, and when they first invented them, they put them inside the bank, so you couldn't get your money out in the evening or at the weekends. Now there was a kind of a big shift in the mindset, a paradigm shift, and people started putting them out into the walls. I love the idea of getting money out of a wall. I really do, and that's the paradigm shift we need for the formal institutions. Let me press on with my, there's lots of comments coming through, but I have got some brief conclusions and then open to more, more debate. From an institutional impact perspective, the theme of the conference, I agree with George. It's the culture thing that creates the challenge, and I've hit this face to face. It's my role to do this in the university. Institutions often have a well-established culture that exists in a political, cultural, social framework where new practices, if indeed they are new, these things with cultural resources for learning of the new media that I'm talking about, create a big challenge. I know they create a big challenge. However, I'm maintaining that the mobile wave can be regarded as cultural resources for learning. By recognizing and drawing on cultural resources that are already or will soon be widespread, I'm convinced that some institutions can add the pedagogy of scaffolding or something similar, whatever George has got in mind or anybody out there, because I don't think I've got the answers, all the answers. I've got some perspectives, something similar to ride the mobile wave. And there you go. Come on, let's have some questions. Sorry, I was staring out the window to the gherkin when I was talking and to you, and then kept looking at all these things on the left, thinking, my God, there's a lot going on there. So if I've missed something, if there's been some really contentious questions, then let's get them out there. Come on. Yes, whoever's got your hand up. I don't know where you look to see who's got the hand up. Go ahead.
Hi, testing. I hope you can hear me.
Hi, Rhonda.
I can hear. Great. Okay. John, there was a question I see Peter Gibbs has put, which I was thinking of as well. It's that thing about how much technology you require people to have before they actually do a course. Do you want to comment on that and just on the cost of that?
Before, how much technology do they have before they do what?
Before they actually take a course, if you make that a requirement, I'm thinking about the sort of barrier that you present before somebody can actually sign up to do a course.
Well, my thrust is you use the technology they've already got. What our university, and we're an access university, and we've been hammered for this by Hefke, but we do have a good access policy, and we've really brought a lot of students through. I've taught them personally. Is we, if you can't afford one, the kit, there's a scheme that allows you to buy one. But I think we expect people to buy books. And I think you should just look at it in those terms. If people want to come and study and succeed, and then you would, we are actively talking about the lightweight laptops, expecting them to have that. We've got a minimum requirement type idea. And if you've got problems with the funding that, then we will help you as a university. That's what we have. We have an access mission. But increasingly, these things are dirt cheap. They are very cheap. The one laptop per children, they've come right down in price. And I think the cost issue is going to go away. What the issue is a digital literacy issue. Some students can use them. Some students can't, and it's not just for students, it's staff. Some students can and can't use it, so that's the issue for me. Tariffs, I've just seen this come up. I think universities, do you remember CHEST in higher education? We banded together and got the idea of and we want mobile broadband, that's free. I agree, I see the comments. But CHEST allows us to get software for cheap. We are not banding together yet with them and taking on the mobile operators and getting a cheap deal for adult and community education, for further education, higher education. We need to get together. And I said this to Mike Sharples once, and he said, well, John, who's going to do it? Why don't you do it? So, yeah, maybe if there's anyone out there who thinks we ought to get something going, then maybe we should. Paul's saying skills are a bigger barrier than access to technology. Yes, it's the skills. And I think if you think about it, in terms of access, these technologies are seen as cool, and so it's not seen. Some students don't want to do edu, the kind of the neat, the hard to get tos. But whereas mobile phones are cool, and you can use it as a kind of Trojan horse. Anyone else? Yes, go ahead. Go ahead, whoever's got your hand raised.
Steve here.
Hi, Steve.
Yeah, hi there. You just skipped out. You kind of skipped quickly off that last slide, and you kind of mentioned what I would agree with is one of the biggest problems is the cultural or political climate within institutions. And I noticed the conversation has shifted very quickly back to technology again. So I just wanted to question you on, you say you've hit this face on, so what are you actually doing, or what have you tried in terms of, say, cultural change, institutional change? What techniques can you pass on?
For the last 1.5 years, I've been part of the executive, the e-learning project leader. And because of if you don't know, colleagues, we've got a £38 million clawback from Hefty, 500 redundancies, 230 odd are probably going to be compulsory. I'm living and working and breathing in a very difficult environment. But it's not all bad news. In the RAE, my unit, we came in the top fifth for the whole of the UK for research. So I'm working in a challenging but exciting environment. What I'm doing now is I'm part of a four-person team. We're part of the executive called the Technology and Enhanced Learning and Teaching Assessment and Learning Executive Working Group, and we've gone around every department, faculty, and asked subject areas to come up with pedagogic blended learning plans, and we've helped them with this. And what we've done is we've gone in on a pedagogy ticket. We've talked about it because I'm perfectly able to. I was submitted in the education RE. I'm a practitioner of many years standing. I'm a university teaching fellow, and I work as a president of ALT. I love bringing together practitioners, research, and policy. And what we're doing is we've got them the departments through the different subject areas to come up with plans for how to do the blended learning. We've presented to them a particular view on blended learning. I'm allocated now personally to about three big faculties. We're looking at quick wins for September given the current climate, and I go and visit them and give them tips on we have to look at what's useful for each subject area. That's proven to be the big ray of sunshine in the university. People really engage with this massively. We just had a staff conference. Julie Salmon came and talked and really did a great talk, got people inspired, and she does a good slide where she looks at the link between what's happening now and how you link that into research. But it's all done through the pedagogy ticket, and I'm so glad that I've done this, because I feel I've contributed to something to the university at a time when it's very difficult. What's going to happen is we're going to have a real sticky time coming up to September, where there are compulsory redundancies, strikes, and then we are allowed to resubmit to Hefty as part of the people who came up with a plan to Hefty for the restructuring. And one of the big things we haven't achieved at the university is a big network of champions, and then meant people they're bringing along and just nurturing the champions. And so that's part of my proposal, is to funding for champions, and they bring people along. And then we want to, in the next bid to Hefty for restructuring, I'm getting the message that that's going to go, we're going to resubmit that. So I, Steve, I hope that answers your question. Do you want to come back to me, anyone on that?
Thanks, John. Yeah, it did. Excellent. Thanks for that.
So I think we've got 3 minutes for any more questions. Let's look at the thing. So what have I missed? I'm sorry, I tend to stare off into the middle distance. I'm a bit pretentious. Let me look at these talkings that are coming through. I feel an FE-HE divide coming on. Well, as someone who's... that's Ellen Lesner. I worked in FE for 2 years, and you've got... what's it called? MoleNet. You've got the thing, the mobile learning thing going on there, but... I think some of us are going to be some, I don't want it to happen. Some institutions in HE may go to the, I don't know, will they let it happen, go to the wall? I know there's about 6 or 7 on Hefty's danger list. There was in the Times Higher this morning I was reading. And we're going to have, some of us are, the research is not going to be spread out anymore. It's going to be more concentrated in the research intensive university. So pockets of excellence like my own are going to become a rarity, I think, unfortunately, in terms of research. So we're going to become more vocational. So is that necessarily true? Will we become a more of a divide? Or will there be parts of the HE that become more stronger links with FE? And there's Lucy Stone saying, after working with Julie Salmon on a project, I feel HE approach is vastly different from FE practitioner. Yeah, I do know quite a bit about FE, and I would like anyone to expand on that. My partner, Terry Kinnison, worked for them for a long time, so I do know they had a great system where they, I forget what it was called, but you had practitioners putting the hot potatoes up and discussing them in a very active way. I do like the FE approach. It's much more open, actually. Anyway, so I think a lot of funding, this is Lucy again, a lot of funding is aimed at HE. There is this, What was a great shame, a colleague of mine, Diana Lorillard, worked in the DFES for the kind of harnessing technology program. She had a unified view of adult and community education, FEHE, and work-based learning. And that kind of got dropped when she left through political reasons. So that was a great shame. I think someone wants to come in now. Yeah, whoever's got your hand up, come in.
Hi, John. That's me. And I really just wanted to do my moderator thing and say that we are coming up to the break and to say thank you very much for what's been an extremely productive discussion, both in the audio, in the slideshow, and in the chat on the sidebar. You've been a splendid presenter. This is the first time I've worked with a presenter that's followed the chat stream successfully, avoided getting distracted by all the hecklers out there, and gave us an extremely provocative and interesting vision of at least how some of the near future might look with respect to the range of learner-owned technologies that are available. So just to invite everybody to show the appreciation to John in the usual way, can't you just hear that swelling roar of applause?
Yes, it's wonderful. Well, let me say, I thoroughly enjoyed it. It's been an honor for me to be invited to do this. I love doing this sort of thing. It's like doing a gig. I get a thrill from it. So thank you so much, everyone. And get back to me if you've got any more thoughts.